sense of strength. If both persons have the same conviction, the problem of the home is practically solved, because both will then support the home itself, the entity, which can only exist because it is reasonably and intelligently maintained by the inner strength of all the members. Under such conditions also, children will be taught from birth practically the importance of inner strength. They will be taught the basic principles of relationship, not by word alone, but by example. They will learn from the conduct of their parents why this conduct is better than the conduct of their neighbor's parents. They will realize little by little what integrity means. And most of all, these children will never experience confusion as this generation has experienced it. From the beginning, they will be capable of silence. They will be capable of quietude. They will find peace with themselves. This type of thing going on into every phase of life moderates ambitions, clarifies responsibilities, and gives the person in his work the inner tranquility against the pressures of those who have no inner resources. With quietude inside, we can carry a prodigious amount of work with practically no damage. With quietude inside, we can adjust to the whims and problems of the times. We are not injured, we are not destroyed. We understand, we realize, we recognize, and whenever tension or stress arises, we seek to experience the truth of it. And the truth of all stress is quietude. So we get beyond these surfaces. And we find that our health and our state of mind and gradually our social position all are improved. Then as we go along into the closing years of life, we are liberated from the strange negation that so often creeps over the elderly. We are no longer concerned about either past or future, for that matter. Meditation reveals to us quietly the eternity of existence, the eternity of life. The individual who has gone inside of himself has left this world and come back a number of times. He has left this world whenever he sought the consolation of consciousness and insight. He finds, even while he lives here, that the world is not necessary to him, that it is an interlude, that it is something from which he learns, but that of itself it is not his, nor is he bound to it by any rule or power other than his own voluntary acceptance of worldliness. As he proceeds further along, he also discovers what most of the Zen have discovered, the importance of the long, quiet evening of tranquility. It is after the beginning, we might say, of this third part of life that the great artist in man reveals its genius. Here the person who has been thoughtful, who has experienced and understood, suddenly finds himself the possessor of a tremendous artistry. He begins to recognize the incredible resource within himself. He finds that he is richer than he ever dreamed he could be, and that every part of his life is filled with worthwhileness in all of its aspects and conditions. He also then realizes that age is reward, not punishment. That in the long, quiet evening, he can have the great joy of fulfillment. This last spring, summer, when I was in Kyoto, I went out to one of the Zenji temples there. The little temple in the hills, it was pouring rain, and it was a hard place to find, not much visited by strangers. But it had a little garden about half the size of this auditorium. This little garden was a place of extraordinary quietude, of great peace. And alongside of the garden, on one edge, was a veranda. It was what is called a viewing garden. You didn't walk around in it. You sat down in some convenient place under the veranda, and you just looked at it. And even in the rain, there were several interesting persons in that garden when I got there. There was an elderly man who was obviously a lay monk. That is, he was simply a Japanese gentleman who, having achieved around his 65th year, had voluntarily become a lay brother. He did not take the full obligations of a monk, but he became one who liked to visit the temple, who put on part of the robes of the monk, but did not take all of the obligations. But he was a lay brother, as we call them. He was sitting quietly on a mat near one end of the veranda, his hands in his lap, just simply looking out over a beautiful little pool and watching the golden carp flashing in the raindrops. The surface of the pool was agitated by the rain, and the fish cut through it with most beautiful leaps and jumps. There was a little spring that fed the pool, and the water was dropping over the edge of it. It was all very quiet. The gentleman was not really in meditation. He was simply wrapped in rapture of the scene. A strange, deep, wonderful smile was on his face. He was just supremely happy. He was happy in the presence of beauty. He was sort of inhaling it. He was living upon it. He did not eat very much at that time of life. He didn't sleep a great deal. He didn't need it. He wasn't working very hard. His family were taking care of him, as was the custom. But he needed nourishment. And his great joy was to come and sit and watch the fish in the pool. At the opposite end of the long veranda was a mother with two or three small children. She also came simply for garden viewing, and so did the children. The children were 3 or 4 or 5 years old, quite small, but they were very, very quiet. And they too, in their own way, were absolutely entranced with the beauty of it. Suddenly a little break came in the clouds and a ray of light struck through the rain, which was still falling, and spread itself on a little stone pagoda by the side of the pool. It was a beautiful scene, just for a second. And the little children almost cried out in their acceptance and adoration of this beauty. They almost reached out their chubby little hands to grasp the sunbeam that came. They were happy, simply in the observation of beauty. Between them, partway down the veranda, was a third person, a young woman in her middle 20s, with a sketch pad, a young Japanese woman who was making a drawing of the scene. I learned from the monk in the monastery there that she came almost every day to draw there. She was a self-taught artist. And because she was taught only by the quietude of the garden, she had already won several prizes. She took no lessons. She simply accepted the teaching of the pool and the lantern and the waterfall. And she was completely absorbed in making the beautiful little sumi drawings of all the moods and shapes and forms of that little garden with its rocks and its moss and its trees and the shadows that they cast upon ancient pathways. Here was a Zen garden. The young, the middle-aged, and the old, all finding in it beauty. which was its common message. Because this Zen garden is life. And at every age of life, we should find our world beautiful. And if we don't find it beautiful, it is because we have deformed it. And to restore that beauty, we must understand it again in ourselves. And if we can understand it in ourselves, we can recapture this beauty at any moment. And in recapturing it, we also give a great example to others. In going into this little garden and seeing these people there, each absorbed in his own meditation, in his own way, the meditation of childhood, laughter, and happiness. The meditation of the young woman, capturing beauty with a brush. The meditation of the elderly lay monk, whose meditation was with quiet folded hands, simply drinking in eternity. These meditations were important to me also. I learned something from them. And from the contemplation of life, both those who participate and those who observe become better, become richer as an experience in themselves. And the little monk who kept the place told me that families came. And an interesting thing about both Zen and Buddhism in general is the way in which the family does appear. It will arrive with hampers and baskets for a picnic. And in the very holy grounds of the temple, perhaps even before the altar, you will hear the laughter of children. Their religion is laughter, not solemnity. And the old monk, who is the guardian of the place, beams from ear to ear. He is very happy, for he has discovered that people come to his temple to laugh, to be happy, to enjoy themselves, to reunite families, to bring together all the common pleasures of the time. This is very good. But it's because it is not solemnity, but freedom of inner joy that is really the keynote of the Zen ministry. So in each area of our life, this ministry becomes one a fulfillment, never a frustration. And if we can begin to think about it, we can't start earlier than we learn. We cannot begin earlier than now. But always we can begin the moment we realize what Zen tells us. That some way, somehow, we must live with ourselves forever. That there is no way of escaping this strange, confused thing we call ourselves. There's no way of getting over our grudges, no way of getting past our prejudices, except by meditation, by quietly letting go of them, by discovering instead of this world of our personal antagonisms, the greater world of universal peace. Sometime we must all make this adjustment because we are going to get desperately tired of being unhappy. Especially when we realize that happiness is no further away than little golden fish dancing in a pool. That this happiness is not something on the other side of life or on the other side of the universe. It is simply man accepting the tremendous evidence of the divine plan. It takes anywhere from 200 to 400 years to create a Zen garden. Some are rocks alone. Some are rocks and sand. Very few have any flowers, because flowers fade. And the blossom that is here today is gone tomorrow. Zen wishes to emphasize rather timelessness. So he takes the little trees and the plants that are truly perennial, and it makes out of them its gardens. And these gardens actually are merely meditations captured in a little square of ground where land is almost priceless. In this country, we would never sacrifice that much land for a garden. It is impossible to estimate the number of little gardens in the heart of Tokyo. Gardens that are 6 feet square, 4 feet square, 2 feet wide and 6 feet long, or a tiny little garden hidden under the washtub for lack of any other place. These gardens have their tree and their lantern and their waterfall, and the growing value of property in Tokyo today is $5,000 a square foot. And yet there is room for a garden. Why? Because a garden is not just simply a luxury. It is man restating his faith in life. The garden is the acceptance that that little green square is forever the open door to eternity. It has to be. It has to be because individuals cannot be locked away from reality. They cannot forget beauty or how easily it can be captured. And when it is captured, how universal it becomes. So each person in his own part of life, in his own section of life, must, I think, develop a certain amount of Zen insight. He needs it very much these days. He needs to have the tranquility of an unchanging reality through which he passes. He must realize that his youth and his maturity and his advancing years are essentially only moods. Moves in the conditioning of his own nature. If he has been young and is old, he will be young again. Whatever time of life he passes through, he has passed this way before and will pass many times in the future. Life is a great cycle of returns, of restatements. Each, however, on a little different level of insight, each with a little more of consciousness, each with a little less of pain. And the individual builds this way. I think there is a great need in our Western life now. We are reaching a terrible crisis in our discontent. We are gradually coming to a condition in which we must find peace or perish. I do not think that nature wants us to perish or has any intentions of letting us perish. I think that nature is going to gradually force upon us this maturing of ourselves. And the example of how it is done occurs in our own personal lives, from youth to maturity to the dignities of advancing years. These are processes of maturing. But they also are symbols of another dimension of maturity that we have to achieve through insight. If we will then start wherever we are with our quiet practice of Zen, I think it will help us. For one thing, we may have to start alone. It is quite possible that if we tried to bring all our friends and relatives into this attitude, we would have a great deal of opposition. But one wonderful thing about Zen is that it does not depend upon what other people do. It depends only upon what we are. And if we can become clear enough, if we can become wise enough and quiet enough, we can meet without fear anything that anyone else can do. We are not any longer dependent upon other people. Our joys and sorrows are no longer in the names of those around us. We have restored these rights to ourselves. This is not a selfishness. We are not out to be happy at the expense of anyone else. But it is only fair to realize that happiness is something that we can possess more of without anyone else actually being deprived of any of it. Some may not appreciate our happiness. They may resent it and be jealous of it. But actually, we are taking nothing from anyone else when we add to our own inner consciousness. We are not less reliable servants. We are not less thoughtful parents or less kindly friends. All of the virtues that we normally possess are increased rather than diminished. The only thing that is taken away from it is the strange subjective instinct to hurt. We no longer desire to build upon the pain of other things. We no longer wish to add one tiny fragment to the sorrows or miseries of the world. We wish to digest, assimilate, and transform within ourselves everything that is negative, everything that is evil, so that in no way will we add to the suffering of anything. Nor will we carry ill report against anything, nor add to the doubts that others may hold. Our purpose is always a quiet, strong strength, a strength that is based upon a true insight, an insight that has gone so deep that it has always found the good, which is at the root and core of everything that exists. So we can take our little Zen garden of the world and divide it likewise into its seasons and its climates. The little Zen garden at Kyoto has a great beauty at the dawn, in the break of day, in the early hours of morning. It has a wonderful beauty when life seems to burst forth. This is the youth of man. For in those hours the morning glories open along the fence. The birds awaken. And the fish capture on their shiny bodies the first rays of the dawning sun. Then comes the strong, quiet light of noon that seems to cast no shadows. Here all the world is busy, and the little insects are fulfilling their destinies. And all things are growing, and the water in the pool is touched by the breeze. Then comes the long, quiet hours of evening, and the pool is again greatly changed, and the little garden is altered, and perhaps late in the night, the moon casts its reflections in the pool, until it seems that the moon itself has come down from the sky. These are the moods of the garden. This garden is life. Some will say I like the dawn better than the sunset, but who knows? For if there are creatures that belong to the dawn, there are creatures likewise that belong to the sunset. Some sing in the morning and some at night. Some find their strength in the brightness of the day, some in the long, quiet twilights of the evening. But this is life, one mystery lighted by the various aspects of consciousness. There is the rising sun of consciousness, the noon sun, and the long, quiet afternoon and evening. The garden does not change, but it seems to change as the shadows change. So this is life. We are living one life in three aspects. Each of these aspects is strangely fulfilling. And if Zen can reach into our consciousness, it can help us to see all this fulfillment. A difficult youth has not been lived in vain, for it has given us great insight if we allowed ourselves to grow. The responsibilities of maturity are not less desirable than the leisure of age. Each of these stages has its own beauty, its own wealth, its own meaning, its own consciousness. And finally, in the long, quiet evening, There is a grace, a gentleness, a peace, a freedom from the pressures and stresses of the day, and these quietudes are also great rewards. Everything is reward instead of penalty if our own inner consciousness sees straight. So Zen is, as far as I can realize, if not by name, at least by what the word means, is the only answer to the non-tranquilities of our hearts and minds. Zen is the only experience that can make us greater than our needs. It is the only approach to life that takes away all the bitterness and leaves only the beauty. Though some may say, of course, that it is a form of self-delusion, that the world is not beautiful, that the little pool is not beautiful. It's only our own looking at it that makes it beautiful. Well, who really cares? Who cares what is the cause of happiness as long as it comes? Who is really concerned about the substance of peace if he lives within its transforming power? Who really is much mattered by it all? What we come to do is to live, to learn, and to meet the transitions of years with as much joy and dignity as we can. And all the values of this experience we call life depends upon the light of our own consciousness, making these values to shine. If consciousness does not enlighten them, all these values seem to be monotonous tragedies, disillusionments, and disasters. But lit by the light of inner concepts, they are all lessons, opportunities, privileges, realizations that have great meaning for us. So I don't think it is very important whether we can prove any of these things logically or rationally. I don't think the Zen would be much interested in trying to prove anything. All he is interested in is experiencing oneness with life. If he experiences this oneness, no proof is necessary. If he does not experience it, no proof helps him very much. It is all simply the action of his own personal consciousness. If when we go along through the years, we face these different problems, there are all kinds of attitudes we can take. We can resent, but it does no good. We can worry, but we gain nothing. We can rebel, but what are we rebelling against? Shadows. Circumstances over which we can never achieve a true victory. We can walk out on a situation and try to leave it behind. But the situation walks out with us and remains ours until we solve it. There seems to be no answer to any of these problems except to search for within ourselves for the magic garden of the ancient temple, the garden of clear quietude, the garden in which our consciousness can find the circumstances for true thinking. If we could sit quietly by the side of the little pool of the Zen temple and be very quiet, we would at that time come very close to infallible judgment. For if in that quietude we say to ourselves, is this person good or bad? Is this circumstance important or not important? Is it valuable that I do this or valuable that I do not do that? Our conclusions in meditation would be true almost beyond our conception. For in this mood, there would no longer be any selfishness, self-interest, evasion. We would not drag up old antagonisms and animosities and flaunt them in front of ourselves again. in absolute quietude, we know what is valuable. And as the Zen points out, probably the most important discovery is that very little is valuable except the experience of reality. It makes very little difference whether we achieve wealth or remain poor. It does not mean much whether the masses revolt or the masses do not revolt. Because if they revolt, they simply fall under new masters. There is only one freedom, and that is the freedom from desire. Freedom from attitude. The moment we are free from attitudes as we know them, we do not simply go to sleep and have nothing on our minds from then on. This freedom is not the beginning of inertia or mental laziness or some strange psychic torpor that is going to come over us. This quietude is simply an unfolding of a new dimension of experience, of consciousness. We suddenly understand things. We understand all the things we have sought to explain. Perhaps in the true spirit of Zen, we understand them so well we cannot explain them. But within ourselves, we know the answers. We suddenly know why we are here. We can't tell anyone else, but we know. We know where we're going and where we came from. We know the meaning under the experiences that have caused us agitation and pain. We have also some strange insight into all our mistakes. And in the end, we come, I guess, to the supreme knowledge that men can attain. Namely, that all things exist forever in wisdom and manifest forever as love. Once we know this within ourselves, most other learning is unnecessary. It does not deny the right of learning. Among the Zen people, there are doctors and lawyers and scientists, just as among all other people. But Zen is an attitude toward these things. Zen does not detract from our knowledge, but in some way helps us to find greater uses for our knowledge. Zen does not prevent the scientist from being a scientist, but it lifts him to a union between his science and his consciousness, and he is no longer an intellectualist playing with ideas that he doesn't understand. Also in Zen, strangely enough, understanding itself is ill-defined. We can't say just what it is that is understood. But whatever it is suddenly extraordinarily good. Suddenly all the sorrows and burdens of the world are transformed into beautiful gardens. It's hard to say just how this happens. It can never be forced upon anyone. But I think that the first thing that Zen gives us is complete dedication to the highest. And the second thing that it gives us is perfect freedom in perfect obedience. So little by little, we get a new kind of world to live in, a world not of man and his fame, his fortunes, his conflicts, and his ambitions, but a world of growing, in which man makes the direct and immediate journey from his present state to the state of security. That in some mysterious way he moves from now with its insufficiency to an infinite sufficiency. And in the presence of this attainment, the things that we are normally interested in lose most of their value. Yet when we find the old Zen monk who has made a great achievement, perhaps the abbot of one of the old monasteries, we do not find ponderously learned man, looking with deep seriousness upon the sorrows of the world and shaking his head gravely at every misfortune. He is not that kind of learnedness which is carrying all the burden of the world on a frail back. He is most likely to be a very happy, smiling person. And in his face, which may be wrinkled with age, and as like as not, he is shaven-headed, we have something of the strange effect of a child. The wise old man has the face of a newborn babe, a face that is strangely smooth and calm, a face like the child. The child has not learned to be afraid. The wise old man has learned that there is nothing we need to fear. And so by degrees the strain and stress are gone. An extreme wisdom brings back a childlikeness, which gives us an infinite faith in life and in reality, and a very deep affection for our fellow man, a willingness to serve and to help, in which no burden is too great. But above it all, through it all, and in it all, simply a wonderful, radiant happiness. The kind of happiness that can only come to the individual who has found that the dream of misery is really only a dream. And awaking from it, has found God's world, the world of light and peace, and found that it was here all the time. Well, we have over 3 billion people in the world today, most of whom have never found this other world, this world of peace. But it is not out in some other orbit of space. It is not far away where we cannot contact it. This other world is simply the otherness of ourselves. The Zen points out that it is quite conceivable that the individual, in an instant, can become that otherness. That all the light is very, very close to us. That it is no further from us than the light of the sun for the man whose eyes are closed. If he opens his eyes, he sees all. If he closes his eyes, he insists that there is no light. So Zen is not really so complicated a procedure as we might think. It is rather the attainment of the inner peace or quietude by which we dare to open our eyes. Instead of living in a world in which we depend forever upon the words of others coming in our ears telling us what the universe is like, instead of getting our descriptions and definitions of space from scientific formulas or from these strange records held in spaceships, instead of all these things impinging upon us as our only form of instruction, the attitude of Zen is, be quiet and open your eyes. Open your eyes and you will see that this whole universe is one magnificent garden. Close your eyes and it's a battlefield. Open your eyes and all men are your brothers. Close them and most men hate each other. Open your eyes and life is a magnificent experience. Close it, or close your eyes, and life is blindness staggering to the grave. Everything depends on those inner eyes, and you know that they are opening as you perceive the universe as better. Also, as you find that your own life is richer in reality. Open your eyes. Open that inner realization in yourself and find your family. Find your husband or wife. Find your father or mother. Find your children. Find them as experiences of your own consciousness. Learn to understand their need from your discovering your own needs. Close your eyes and you are strangers under one roof. Open your eyes, and life is so full of wonders and so full of treasures that you do not know where to begin. Close your eyes, and in your blindness, struggle desperately for a few shares of stock or a little real estate. Open your eyes and find all religion one. Close them and struggle in a world of creeds. Open your eyes and find life and love and wisdom and laughter. Close your eyes and live in the somber shadow of your own moods. Zen will help to open these eyes if we give it the right to do so. If we cultivate to the best of our ability integrities and try each day to experience a little more beneath the surface of things into their realities. We overcome a little of our own smallness, we will discover more of universal greatness. These are the things we have to do with the years of life. And these are the things that sometime the world is going to have to do if it is to escape the madness of its own blindness. Open our eyes, and the brotherhood of man is a fact. Close our eyes, and atomic bombs hang over our heads. It is all a matter of this mysterious dimension of consciousness. Youth is a dimension of consciousness. Maturity is a dimension. Age is a dimension. But consciousness is above all its dimensions. And life is one. Reality is above all knowledge and aspects of knowledge. It is one. Knowledge comes to us, perhaps, through the limited sensory perceptions that we have developed. But this insight comes to us through an added perception, the power of internal meditation. And it is this meditation that sets us free, but in our freedom, binds us as never before to the eternal plan of which we are a part. Well, our time is up. We thank you very much.